All right. Luke chapter 22, starting a new section. Quite excited about this because we have just kind of finished up with this whole area in chapter 21 where Jesus has gone through like all these gnarly situations explaining the destruction of the temple, talking about war and persecution and the destruction of Jerusalem and his return and the fig tree. And like that's, it's just been nonstop. But kind of what you find here in that section of 21 is he's addressing this group of people who have some interest, his disciples, but now the plot comes back and is refocused upon those who have been trying to get rid of him. And Luke reports here, as you saw kind of at a cursory glance here, Luke reports the religious leaders still have this desire to kill Jesus. This is basically all that they care about. And they have been powerless to accomplish this task thus far. They have not been able to make any headway in this particular area trying to get rid of Jesus. They've sought to stump him with many questions and to catch him in his words before the people. If you recall, if you look back just at chapter 20, he is kind of in this showdown with he's in a little bit of a showdown there with the religious leaders as the Sadducees begin to talk about the resurrection and they're kind of opposing him, and he comes back to them with this comment that really gets the scribes on board with Jesus here. The last thing that you see there in chapter 20, in verse 38, is this. He says, Jesus responding back, and he says, Now he is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him. Then some of the scribes answered, Teacher, you have spoken well, for they no longer dared to ask him any questions. And so what you find there is that they are coming back with this statement there. For a brief moment, it seemed as if these warring factions within the religious leaders, the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, were kind of all aligned to try to get rid of Jesus. But Jesus is so so great with his words. He's so great with communicating the truth that even the scribes are like, that was a great answer. Like, you know, we gotta give you credit for that one. And he begins to divide even that faction that was against him. And so they don't have a way to come back on him verbally. They've been seeking to kill him. If you recall, if you go even back even further into chapter 19 and verse 47, you can read their approach here, their tactic here, that they have been trying to get rid of him even back then. He was teaching daily in the temple. The chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people were seeking to destroy him, but they did not find anything they could do, for all the people were hanging on his words. And so everyone is there coming out to hear Jesus, to understand what it is that he's saying. His teaching is compelling. He is speaking to the hearts of men, and they are responding. And yet it is these religious leaders who have been opposing him. They've been trying to trap him in his words. They've been trying to kill him. But Luke tells us there that they have not been able to because the people are obsessed. They are hanging on Jesus' very words. But now, as we come to chapter 22, a new option is introduced, a new element is introduced into the story. We'll get to that in a second, but Luke opens up for us with the context of reminding us about the time of year, right? Almost passing over, we would have known this kind of coming in off of chapter 18 and chapter 19, but 21 kind of gives us a little bit of a detour. But as we come back into 22, he reminds us of the timeline of the setting. And he says this in verse 1 of chapter 22. Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called the Passover. So let's just break that down a little bit because this could get really confusing if you are trying to pay attention to what he's saying. And also if you read the other Gospels, because he says it here as one, and that's because they're kind of treated as one. The Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Passover are originally separate festivals. but they're regarded as one in practice. And so when he says, like, oh, the Feast of Unleavened Bread is the Passover, they're not exactly the same, obviously, because if you read the book of Leviticus, there's different prescriptions for how these ought to be practiced. You read, you know, those books of the law that outline these things, they are given separate treatments, but they ran up against each other. The Passover was celebrated on the 14th and the 15th of their kind of month that began. Remember, this, the Passover resets the calendar there. They call this month called Nisan, which is N-I-S-A-N, right? Not like the car brand, like one less S, right? But, which happened kind of roughly in the March, April range. And so during the afternoon of the 14th, the Passover lambs were slaughtered at the temple, right? Because you're coming into this kind of period of time where you're making the sacrifices there. And then because the Jewish day begins at sunset, it kind of rolls into the 15th. So the way that that's kind of how it works. And so the evening of that same day was the beginning of another day. And so this is kind of why they're treated as the same. And then the actual feast of unleavened bread that would continue on after from the 15th to the 21st. So they kind of butt up against each other there. But the point of both of these feasts, of course, are rooted in the Exodus, in God's rescue of his people out of Egypt through a deliverer, Moses. And the feast of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread commemorate that, their deliverance. It speaks to that time where the firstborn of Egypt was killed as this kind of final plague, and Israel was passed over as they were covered by the blood of this particular lamb that was painted on the door of the house. And so the next day after that, Israel would have left to go out to the promised land. And the Passover was a kind of a time where, and the Feast of Unleavened Bread was a time where they reflected upon their deliverance, upon going from being oppressed to life, a time where families would gather together and they would sing and offer thanks and sacrifices to God. It was a time of celebration of a new life, of this new promise of God's generosity, of his care. And so, as Luke tells us this, he's not only telling us the time of year, he's also giving us a contrast. Because in this time where there's a holiday season here that is full of celebrating life, the religious leaders scheme together to end the life of the one who comes to bring life. They are plotting to put him to death, even though this is a time to celebrate life. This is not a time to come and to look at how they could murder someone, but of course this is exactly what they do. They should be with their families. They should be celebrating God's faithfulness. They should be celebrating his kindness and his generosity, but instead they are seeking to kill Jesus. Here's how Luke describes it in verse 2. He says, "And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to put him to death, for they feared the people." So their constant focus, their desire, kill Jesus. That's all they care about. That's all they're focused on. And they, once they decided to kill Jesus, they were attempting to do this all the time. But again and again and again, they are stopped by the presence of his supporters. Jesus is quite popular. He had many supporters among the people. People loved to hear him teach. They loved his miracles. And if they would have stopped Jesus in the middle of this, they feared that his supporters would be ready to fight, would be ready to go into battle and start a riot, perhaps, or even to produce these large-scale protests among the supporters. And this would have been not only a fear of a physical attack, being outnumbered, the people outnumbering them by quite a lot, but beyond that, this also would have, if the people were stirred up in this way, if they were protesting and there began to riot, this also would have invited persecution from the Romans, because the Romans would have come in to quell this riot, this protest, and they would have taken power away from the leaders of Israel. They would have put more restrictions in place. They would have removed that which the religious leaders already enjoy, a certain amount of flexibility, a certain amount of power working within the Roman system. And so if they tried to start something, they risk losing power as well. But Luke tells us something particular which is important. He tells us here in verse 2 that they are seeking to put him to death, but they have been unable to do so. They've not been able to do that. Why? Because they feared the people, right? And we just said that there's some practical reasons for that, why they feared the people. But beyond that, this is a stark contrast with what God has, or what Jesus has told us in the book of Luke thus far. He has told us, do not fear man, but fear God, who can kill the body and the soul. These people are not afraid of God. They don't have any respect for him. They are afraid of the people. Their focus is off. They are oriented in the wrong way. They are looking at this, putting all of their efforts, all of their stress upon how are the people going to react, living for the approval of other people, right? And I think that this is easily a temptation that we fall prey to. Every one of us falls prey to the opportunity to look at what expectations are from other people and to become focused there. What are other people going to think, right? And it doesn't just mean what are other people going to think in the sense of people not accepting us socially or from like an area of being popular. But this also could be in the realm of looking at it through the lens of your supervisors or your teachers, your professors, those people, how you respond. How are you going to live in such a way that is focused on making them happy? Now, that's not to say don't be a good steward, and that's not to say you shouldn't do your work or any of that. But sometimes we have this focus that is not healthy on looking for the approval of others, looking at the approval of others as the primary source in our life, when reality is that we should be looking for God's approval, that we should be found in Christ, that we should be looking to do things unto him wholeheartedly. And so these religious leaders, whose chief job was to work unto the Lord, are focused on themselves. They're focused on the approval of others. They're focused on keeping Rome happy. They're not focused on actually understanding what God is doing. And so they are having this particular perspective. They are focused on the people. And this is an opportunity for the enemy to be at work. Look at how Luke puts it in verse 3. He says, then Satan entered into Judas, called Iscariot, who was of the number of the 12. So opportunity comes here when Satan acts. Luke tells us very simply, in a very plain way, that Satan enters into Judas. He's giving us kind of the summary here. If you read John's gospel, right, you'll kind of find this section where they're enjoying the Passover meal, and Jesus hands him, you know, the bread and the wine there, and he tells him, you know, what you do quickly, right? And then it says at that point that Satan entered into him and he went out, right? And so what that option there was in the book of John helps us have a little bit of clarity, because at that point, Satan was using Judas as a vehicle to do what Judas already intended to do. It's not that Judas didn't have any control and he was like, well, you know, like I wasn't able to resist that. Here we find that Jesus, even to the last moment, is offering him the bread and the cup. And he's saying, look, here it is. And it's after he takes that and after he's like, okay, I'm going to go out. Then he is overtaken. He is controlled here to a certain degree. Judas acts. He is responsible. But Satan is the force behind it all. He prompted and maybe even guided Judas in this particular effort, in this crime. But his realistically what happened was that none of this was done against Judas's will. He wanted this. And some suggest that, you know, the reason why Judas did this was he was mad that Jesus didn't set up like this earthly kingdom. You know, where they could rule. Some people kind of have a thought that, well, you know, Judas was the only disciple that was not from Galilee. He was a Judean, so he was of this particular, you know, he's kind of like on the outskirts, and they were like, oh, you know, he was really upset about this, and all these like kind of low-level fishermen guys are like in charge, and it doesn't make any sense, and he's like jealous of that. But it seems here that really is that what we find is that Judas was really just out for himself and all about money. Just like the Pharisees, just like the religious leaders were focused on the approval of people, Judas didn't care about the approval of people. He, in that way, he cared about getting money. He wanted to be wealthy, covetous, right? Remember, he's described throughout the Gospels as caring for the money box and always trying to challenge Jesus when Jesus is spending money to take care of people. He's like, oh, like, we could put that to better use, right? And the Gospels give us insight into that. But this betrayal here reveals his character. It helps us understand that he is with Jesus even up to that last moment. But that itself does not guarantee that he is going to choose Jesus, choose to walk with him, to know him, to grow in faith with him. Instead, he chooses himself. Just because he has a close proximity to Jesus does not mean that he knows Jesus. And clearly, he does not, because he goes out thinking that Jesus is going to be overtaken. He is going to basically come to a complete end as the result of this betrayal here. He's like, I won't have to worry about Jesus because I will be rich and Jesus will be dead. That's the kind of the calculus that's been made. And we read this in verse 5. He went away and conferred with the chief priests and the officers how he might betray him to them. And they were glad and agreed to give him money. So Luke tells us, here's the deal. He goes out. He discusses this betrayal with the Jewish leadership. And we're told here, he goes out and he does this. What in verse 5 tells us? He does this for a fee. They agree to give him money. Judas is paid for his services. He is purely out for this. He could have done it for free, right? If he was just really like, oh, I'm going to show them. I'm going to like really, you know, stick it to them. But this tells you he is focused upon the money. If he just wanted to get rid of Jesus, if he wanted to get rid of all the disciples, he could have just been like, look, like I'll just rat them all out to you and you'll be rid of them. And like maybe just like give me some sort of like random kind of like position in your organization. But he just is like, I just want money. That's all I care about. I don't need to be associated with you guys. These guys are going to be gone. I just want the money. This is his focus. And it very much aligns with what Paul tells us in 1 Timothy. In 1 Timothy 6, verse 10, Paul shares that the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs, right? Isn't that descriptive of what happens here? It becomes such a draw, this craving for money, for wealth, for resources, to provide for yourself, to take care of yourself is so strong that it pulls people away from faith. And that seems to be descriptive of what happens here for Judas as well. He's like, maybe at some point he thought like, hey, like this Jesus guy's pretty cool. But eventually, he wants to be rich. So there's an exchange that happens. They get rich, or Judas gets rich, and the religious leaders are very happy about this. He tells us in verse 5, they were glad. It means that the leadership, they rejoiced. They could not believe the luck that they had. Since there were around like 100,000 people in and around Jerusalem, if they had to find Jesus in the middle of this crowd that everyone's traveling here for the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the city is swelling with people, and now we got to track down Jesus. This is like, in a regular time, they couldn't track him down. But now, even more so, they couldn't find him and isolate him in the middle of the night. It just wasn't going to happen with this amount of people around. Someone was going to know. Someone was going to find out. So the chances of finding him were super slim. And so when they get Judas showing up and being like, hey, like I'll show you guys where he's at. I can just like line it up and you guys can just come get him. Like when it's like, when everything is quiet and there's nobody around, we can find a way to get this done. Obviously, they are elated. They're super glad about this. They're not only getting access, not only are they receiving this betrayal from a disciple, from an insider who's going to deliver up Jesus in this private moment so they can avoid the crowd's reaction. But beyond that, if there was trouble, then they could be like, it was this guy Judas. They can blame him. And then further beyond that, if he was on board and they needed someone to give testimony, they could be like, well, this guy Judas, he turned him over and he was with them all the time. And Judas could be bought for any amount of money here. And so if they needed Judas to say something, to be like, hey, we need you to get up there and testify that like he's done these wrong things, I'm sure Judas would get right in line and be like, yeah, show me the money. So they are loving this, super stoked about this plan, and they are looking at this as a perfect opportunity to grab Jesus. And we find this as the final description in verse 6. So he consented and sought an opportunity to betray him in the absence of a crowd. So that idea there, he accepts the arrangement with the leadership. He begins to look for this opportunity. His goal is to find this time where they can capture Jesus without the crowd being around, make the safe arrest. And this would make the leaders finally successful in their long task that they've been pursuing here of stopping Jesus, of silencing him, of capturing him. They've tried again and again and again, but have been unable to do so. They've gone out of their way to create all of these stories and parables and traps to get him, unable to trap him. And in the end here, it is Judas who is going to deliver him up. Luke tells us here that he consented. That he was with them, and that they agreed to give him money, and what happens here in this is it's kind of a little bit of a behind the scenes situation because it's in original languages here. But what essentially this means is that Judas makes a confession. He's making a confession of faith in this group of people and in this plan. Instead of confessing his allegiance to Jesus, As he consents to this, he is confessing his allegiance to this plan, and in this plan, to himself. To his own future, to what he is going to do for himself, what he is going to provide for himself. And I think as you look at it from that angle, it really helps us understand that this is a temptation that we all face every day. Whether we are going to confess our own allegiance to ourselves and to what we want, and to the attitudes that we want to hold and the places that we want to go, and how we want to spend our money and what we want to do and how we want to be entertained, or are we going to confess our allegiance to Christ each day? That's what he asked us to do. He said that if you want to be his disciple, if you want to walk with him, then you should deny yourself and take up your cross and follow him. Clearly, Judas was not on board because he was not about denying himself. He was about himself. He wanted what he wanted. But the call of Christ is for us to give up our lives for his sake. And in giving up our lives, as he said, we will find them. We will find that which we are willingly giving up. The tighter that we try, or the harder that we try to protect our own lives, the more that we lose them. But the more that we confess him, the more that we trust him, the more that we allow him to work in our lives, the more secure that we can be. Because it's not us protecting ourselves, it's the protection of Jesus, of his care, of his concern, of his provision for us. And so this is an opportunity for us to encounter this daily, just like each person in this story had to do. Each person had to get up on this day. The chief priests, the scribes, and had to get up and say, all right, my goal today is to figure out how to kill Jesus. Judas had to get up and say, I'm going to really go through with this. I'm going to focus on this. I'm going to get it done. I'm going to find a way for me to get what I want. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Passover, is about that sacrificial offering. It's about weakness. If the people of Israel in that first Passover were so confident in their own efforts and their own ability that they were going to save themselves, if they wanted to be selfish, they had that opportunity. They had that opportunity. Just like the Egyptians, they had the opportunity. If you do not want to hear the warning, if you think you're going to be able to save yourself, then, don't have anything to do with the lamb. Don't paint your door. Just go ahead, risk it. And we see what came to those who went their own way. They had the firstborn all die. But it was only through that confession of we can't save ourselves, that weakness, that moment of recognizing, no, we think that God is going to be faithful. And he will protect us. That lack of selfishness there. To say, he is who he said he is. He will be faithful. He will take care of us. And as they brought in that lamb and went through the Passover feast and painted the door with the blood of that lamb, as the angel of death came through, they were protected. It was through that confession that they needed saving. They woke up that morning and they chose to be covered by the blood of the lamb. They woke up the next morning to see his faithfulness, that he had saved them. And it was a record as I walked out that out of that door that morning and looked back and said, we're all still here. They could see a record of his faithfulness, what he has done, what he had accomplished. And of course, this is what Jesus leaves for us at the cross. This is what he's about to give to the disciples as they partake together in the Passover feast, as he begins the institution of the Lord's Supper with them, giving them a reminder of what he has done, so that way we can always look back and say, he has been faithful. Let's decide again this morning that we are going to be covered by the blood of the Lamb. We are going to walk with him, and we are going to choose him and not us. It's an invitation that he leaves open to all of us, that he makes available to all of us. And I implore you, choose to be covered by the blood of the Lamb. Let's pray. Lord, we are thankful for your kindness. We're thankful that you have made a way when there was no way, that you opened doors to have new life that we could not open on our own. We could not conquer sin. We could not conquer death. We could not defeat the grave. But you are our victor. You are our firm foundation. You provide for us. You meet every need. And so we want to come now in response to you and to deny ourselves and to take up our crosses and follow you, knowing that you are a good and kind King. And so, Lord, would you be glorified in our lives? Would you be lifted up and exalted as we remember your faithfulness, what you have done, and as that compels us to respond in worship. We love you. Amen.